All right, we're going to begin. Welcome to this two-day workshop. We've got speakers from the UK, the US, Canada, Germany and France, and we're going to hear the news. What is the new philosophy of philosophy? Who knew there were so many people dotted out around London who wanted to know the answer to that question? So after 2 days, hopefully you will know the answer. So I should just say, first of all, that this conference is very generously funded by the British Society of Aesthetics. It's the reason why it's free. If coffee runs out, just remember it was free. We actually expected half the number of people who've registered for the conference. So it's funded by the British Society of Aesthetics, and it's hosted by the London Aesthetics Forum, here in the Institute of Advanced Studies, University of London, in collaboration with the University of Warwick. I'm Dean Costello, and I'm the person who convened this conference. So let me say something about the idea behind it. So there is a standard line in philosophy, particularly in analytic philosophy, about the nature of photography. There's a cluster of related ideas, ideas that you will be familiar with even if you're not philosophers, because they generalize across art as well, even if the vocabulary is different. So a set of ideas about, there's something distinctive about photography as a recording medium relative to handmade pictures such as painting. There's something about the nature of photography's relation to its objects, which is special. And there's something about the way in which photography records those objects, which is special. And that goes by a variety of names: mind independence, causality, mechanism, autometrism, belief independence. But essentially they're getting at the same thought, that there's something distinctive about photography in this regard as a form of depiction. And that puts pressure, at least for philosophers, on how photography might be art, if all of that is true. So that's the sort of standard line. And it seemed to me that for a long time, philosophers at least didn't have an adequate response to philosophers who are interested in the artistic sense of photography, because photography clearly is art, didn't have an adequate response to those worries from within philosophy. But for the last 5 or 6 years, it seems to me, there's the makings of a new theory. So waiting in the wings, as it were, is a new paradigm. And the goal of this conference was to bring people who are working in those debates, particularly the way I think of as pursuing a new philosophy of photography, together to try and see whether the theory has wings, give it a little push. So hopefully at the end of this we'll know. Is there a new philosophy of photography and has it got wings? So that's the telos. Yeah.
Speaking awkwardly, I will now introduce Dermot. So I'm Stacey Fred. I'm one of the organizers of the London Aesthetics Forum, and the members of the forum will mostly be the people who are sharing the sessions today with a few extra people. And I'll just say something about Dermot. So Dermot works on aesthetic theory as well as philosophy of photography. And unusually for people who give talks to the London Aesthetics Forum, he works in both the analytic and continental traditions. And I actually met Dermot when he was the chair of the British Society of Aesthetics Executive Committee, and we miss him very much. He was a great chair. Dermot's been a Lieberkühn Senior Research Fellow and a Humboldt Fellow here in Frankfurt, and he co-directed the AHRC project on aesthetics after photography. So if Dermot doesn't know what the new philosophy of photography is, nobody does. Okay. Thank you, welcome, Dermot.
Okay, so what I'm going to do is somewhat atypical for papers that I normally give. I'm just going to try and give you a roadmap of what I take to be the debate. So my title is What's So New About the New Philosophy of Photography? And the way I'm going to try and give you this roadmap is to say something about the old philosophy of photography and then try and motivate some thoughts about how the new philosophy of photography departs from some internal inadequacies with the old philosophy of photography. So the first thing you need to know is that one way of identifying what's new here is to focus on the kind of questions asked. So, overwhelmingly, philosophers who are interested in philosophers who are representative of what I'm calling the old theory used to be concerned with epistemic questions, which is to say, given certain starting assumptions about photography as a particular kind of recording apparatus, they thought it followed that that gave photography an intrinsic epistemic privilege. So one of the differences here is that it seems to me that the philosophers I'm calling the new philosophers of photography aren't asking that question. And they're not asking it because they don't start from assumptions about the mechanistic nature of photography as a recording medium. So one of the respects in which the questions are new is that the question is no longer, is photography an art? That's the question a skeptic would ask. The question is, when is photography an art? And when it's an art, what makes it so? So that's the question I'm interested in. New answers to the question, when is photography art? And I'm going to take as my guiding thread recent debates about fictional competence. Fictional competence is often taken by a group of philosophers as a kind of barometer of photography standing as an art. And so it's one of the places in which the discrepancies between the old and the new theory come out most clearly. Okay, so here's a classic exponent of the old theory, Roger Scruton, on representational art. So I'll just read this. Representation in art has a special significance, precisely because of the possibility that we can understand it in the sense of understanding its content while being indifferent or unconcerned with its literal truth. That is why fictional representation is not merely an important form of representational art, but in fact the primary form of it, the form through which the aesthetic understanding finds its principal mode of expression. Okay, so fictional representation is where we look to find the artistic significance of photography, but the relation between a photograph and its subject is a causal relation. If A is the only cause of B, then the existence of B is sufficient for the existence of A. The photograph lacks that quality of intentional in existence, which is characteristic of painting. The ideal photograph, therefore, is incapable of representing anything unreal. If a photograph is a photograph of a man, there is some particular man of whom it is a photograph. Okay. So in the background to this way of thinking about photography is a certain view about representational art, and I'll just say something very briefly about that. It essentially consists in two components. There's the idea that representational art is the expression of a thought, and what makes it aesthetically interesting is it's an expression of a thought in an aesthetically engaging form. And the important point is that photographs, to be aesthetically interesting, must not only make the world available to view, which is to say, record appearances, they must also express a particular point of view about the appearances they record, which is to say, they must not merely show what was the case, they must show it in some particular light, as being one way rather than another. So the how is important. The how is what gives you the artistic status. Why? Because the how shows you what the artist thought or intended or meant for you to intuit about what is represented. Okay, and the claim is, Scruton's claim is, that the causal nature of photography, because it's merely a recording of appearances, cannot, if that's true, show you appearances in some way rather than another. They just show you how things appear at a particular moment in time. So they're incapable of engaging this aesthetic interest in how what is depicted is depicted. Okay, so let me just spell out something really obvious. Here's the background assumption to this whole debate about fictional competence. Okay. Fictional entities cannot leave non-fictional traces in non-fictional photosensitive materials, right? If they're invented rather than recorded, they aren't there to leave a trace in a photographic medium, right? So the question is, the new philosophers is a tough one, right? One way of getting at the question is, could photograph depict fictions strictly photographically? That is, in basis of being the recording medium that the old philosophers think that it is. Okay, So that's the question that Scruton bequeaths us. And there's been various moves in the philosophy of photography to try and kind of nuance Scruton's position. So, and the question is, do they actually get us out of Scruton's position or not? So one philosopher who's associated with this is Greg Curry. Greg Curry basically buys into, I think it's fairly clear, Greg Curry buys into the Scrutonian position. He has a distinction between what he calls traces and testimonies. So the thought is pretty simple. Photography belongs to the class of traces, which is to say, photographs are mind-independent records of how the world stood at a particular moment in time. So seismographs, thermostats, death masks, footprints, those are all traces, right? So it's not a pictorial category. The contrast class is testimonies, right? Which is, unsurprisingly, mind-dependent records of how the world was at a particular moment in time. So that would include diaries, paintings, chronicles, descriptions. So they depend on their records, if you like, of what the recorder thought was the case at a particular moment in time, and they go via those beliefs. Right? Now, on this account, photographs clearly belong in the former camp, and it looks like they're going to be fictionally incompetent. Right? Because fiction is invented, it relies on the mental states of the inventor. Now, despite that appearance, Curry is squarely with Scruton on this, he wants to nuance the Scrutonian account, so he says, okay, it's true that photographs are traces, but they have a circumscribed fictional capacity nonetheless, right? This is what Curry says. If a photograph represents the fictional, they are not photographs of fictional things. There is a difference between what a photograph is of and what it is about. A photograph can be about things other than it is of. What it is of is just the thing that it is a trace of, something we can identify by examining brute causal connections. That's the Scrutonian view. But if the photograph is part of a fiction, then it may also be about things, fictional things, other than the things it is of. That is, a photograph or film image has potentially at least two representing functions. It represents in virtue of being a photograph, and in thus representing, it represents the things and events of which it is a trace. But a photograph can also have another representing role, a role imposed on it by its association with some narrative. So it looks like what's going to leave a photography out of this domain of being mere trace is that it is somehow about something rather than merely of something. And what allows it to be about something is its role in a narrative. So we've got two questions we need an answer to. The first is, what does it mean to be about rather than of something? And the second is, what does it mean to be part of or associated with a narrative? Okay, so the distinction between about and of here is one that's familiar in the literature, and I'm going to take this as being basically coextensive with a famous distinction of Pat Maynard's between being a photograph of X and a photographic picture of X, where being a photograph of X is just to be of X, a causally downstream of X, but to be a photographic picture of X is to somehow be not merely of X, but also about X, right? So in Maynard's philosophy, in the case of photographs that are of something, they, to employ a slight bit of technical language, they depict what they detect, right? So they show they are pictures of what they were caused by. But in the case of photographs that are about something, which is to say, in Maynard's view, photographic pictures, what they depict may be something different to what they detect. So let's see how this would go. Here's a famous example, the Cottingley fairies, where two Victorian children made fools of Arthur Conan Doyle, I think, by allegedly photographing fairies at the bottom of the garden. So, right, let's just motivate the distinction. What's the claim? The claim is they detect cardboard cutouts in front of a girl, but they depict the fiction that there were fairies at the bottom of the garden. Here's Curry's example. This is Juliet Margaret Cameron's illustrations of Lord Tennyson's poem about King Arthur, and the claim is, well, they depict King Arthur and the May Queen, but they detect the particular sitters who sat for the pictures. Take this pair. So on the right, you have a photograph that detects Laurence Olivier, and it also depicts Laurence Olivier. So what it detects and what it depicts are the same. It's about what it's of. But on the left, you have a picture of, if you buy the distinction, you have a picture of Othello, right? That is to say, it depicts or is about Othello, but it detects or is a trace of Laurence Olivier, because Laurence Olivier was the one in front of the camera. Right? So note that on this account, a photograph can be both of and about, right? And those can be distinct things. So the photograph on the left actually detects Laurence Olivier. It detects Laurence Olivier got up as Shakespeare's Moor of Venice, right? But it depicts Othello, right? Those are two distinct representational roles the photograph may hold. This is one of my favourite examples. This is from the much neglected 1976 version of King Kong. You know the one where it goes up the Empire, not the Empire State, the World Trade Centers? That's got a historical significance now. So the thought would be, okay, what does the picture on the left depict? It depicts Jessica Lange being cradled in the hands of King Kong, right? But what does it depict? Well, it actually depicts, sorry, what does it detect? It actually detects a pair of mechanical arms. Sorry, I said that wrong. It doesn't depict Jessica Lange. It depicts the heroine cradled in the arms of King Kong. But it actually detects Jessica Lange being supported by mechanical arms. Okay, so that's what it means to be about as opposed to of something. It's to be about what the fiction determines as opposed to merely of what is in front of the camera. Okay, so the question is, need Scruton, the position we started from, really disagree with any of this? Okay, you've shown that if you buy Curry's account, you've shown that photographs have this limited fictive capacity, which is to say they can, in virtue of being part of a narrative, they can be about something that they don't detect. But all that does is it shows you that some, if not all, photographs may represent ficta, but only by recording non-ficta, right? So at the first order level, photographs remain fictionally incompetent, which is to say they're recordings of what was in front of the camera. Even if they can be, those recordings can be reused in virtue of being located in a narrative to depict something other than what was in front of the camera. There is no 60-foot ape, right? So if they're depicting a 60-foot ape, then they're not depicting something that was in front of the camera. Now, it seems to me that there's nothing here that Scruton really needs to disagree with, because at the primary level, photographs remain fictionally incompetent. Okay, so I think I've basically told you the answer to this already, which is, what does it mean in the second question to be part of a narrative? It's for the photograph to take its meaning from the narrative in which it's embedded. And the thought is that photographs can depict something other than thereof, but they struggle to do so because the narrative resources of photography are slight by comparison with the narrative resources of film. And the thought is that film has a capacity to be imaginatively engaging in virtue of its narrative, but photography doesn't. So it's easy to see how that goes. An example we've already seen, Jurassic Park, North by Northwest. So the thought is the capacities of film, which is not mere photography, right? It's photographs projected 24 frames a second with sound, with narrative and so on. They give film a capacity that photography doesn't have. But note that this is a distinction in degree rather than kind. So the thought is, for film it's easier, right? But at the primary level, even in film, film represents by origin merely what was in front of the camera, which is to say what it's a trace of. The narrative allows it to use what was in front of the camera for fictional ends. But at the primary level, both photography and film are constrained by what they are traces of. Okay. Why do I stress that? I stress that because it tells you something about what's underlying Curry's position and which underlines the entirety of the old theory as I'm characterising, which is to say, at the bottom level, when you get right down to it, what's doing the heavy lifting is the distinction between paintings and photographs, right? Or drawings or mammographs and photographs, right? Things that are hand-rendered. Okay? Why is that? Because the claim is that what paintings, to take just a sort of emblematic example of a mammograph, what paintings represent by origin is not constrained by what was in front of the painter while they painted. What determines what a painting represents is allegedly successfully realized intentions. What's an successfully realized intention? Well, it's successfully realized if I paint a picture of King Arthur and you, the audience, recognize that the picture is a picture of King Arthur, right? I did not need King Arthur in front of me, right? So paintings have a capacity to represent by origin fictions, and photographs don't. There's nothing Scruton need disagree with here. Now, one worry you might have is, doesn't this underplay the representational or narrative possibilities of photography itself? So one can think of many photographic practices in recent art, such as Cindy Sherman's untitled film stills, which are clearly narrative in intent, right? I mean, there are little cues in these. She's always looking off camera. There's always the implication that something is about to happen. So there's a narrative dimension to this photography. Yeah. Or, more recently, Gregory Crewdson's narrative photographs. Right? These are all elaborately constructed, almost like film sets. So you might say, okay, both Scruton and Curry arguably underplay the narrative capacity of photographs. But that won't yet get you what you need, because all that's saying is, well, maybe photography is more like film than they give credit for. Maybe it's possible for photographs to have richly engaging narratives as well. I mean, there's a whole school now of narrative photography. Think of Hannah Starkey amongst various others, right? But that's not yet giving you a difference of kind between photographs and film. It's just said, well, maybe photographs have more similarities with film than we thought. Okay. So what is doing the work here is some conception of what I'm going to call photographic means, right? So we need to be clear about what that conception is. Here's a quote from Curry. Photographic means are just the ordinary operations of camera and film. These operations enable something, the source, to be represented only if it projects light into the camera and onto the film. A representation is photographic when it represents by photographic means, and such means confine us to representation of the source. Nothing Scruton need disagree with there. Right? So to extrapolate from Curry, to represent by strictly photographic means would be for a photograph to represent its source by origin and only so represent. So the challenge for the new philosophers of photography, as I'm setting it up, is can they show photography is fictionally competent by strictly photographic means, by means of representing the source and only so representing it. Only so representing, right? So it does nothing other than represent the source. Okay, right. Enter the new theory, right? That's all been throat clearing. Okay. So So now I'm going to start talking about people who are in the room. This is where the temperature goes down. Right, so I'm going to talk about three philosophers who are in the room today. Dawn Phillips, who's now Dawn Wilson, but confusingly she was Dawn Phillips when this was written. Paloma Atencia Linares and Don Lopez. So these are three of the philosophers that I'm most interested in on photography because I think they're ploughing a new line. So let's just get some like building blocks on the table, and that's how does the new theory depart from the assumptions of the old theory? So here's Dawn, as she's now known, Wilson's, but if you're looking for it, you have to look for Dawn Phillips. Here's Dawn Wilson's account of the old theory, right? So just look at, the first thing to say is she recognizes a multi-stage process, right? So here's what the old theory supposedly embodies. A pro-filmic event of some kind takes place before the camera. The camera takes a photograph of the pro-filmic event. Copies of that photograph, taken to exist at 2, the moment they were taken, are printed. The appearance of the photograph allows the viewer to learn about the appearance of the pro-filmic event. Fairly straightforward set of intuitions. But she proposes the following. A changing light image generated by light sources and objects forms in real time an image on the sensor or the film plane. A photographic event occurs when information from that light image is recorded, though no photograph yet exists, merely the potential for a photograph. Information stored undergoes a process or processes to create a visual image, the photograph, or multiple copies thereof. The appearance of this photograph allows us to learn about the nature of the photographic event. Okay, you don't have to get all of it. What you have to get is the difference between 2 and 3 on the two respective theories. So on theory one, a photograph exists the moment that a light-sensitive surface is exposed to light, right? Click, you've taken a photograph, right? On theory two, all you've done is something necessary but not yet sufficient for a photograph, which is to say you've created a latent image if you're working with film, or you've caused pixels on a film sensor to emit electrical charges. But in neither case have you created a photograph. There's a simple test for this. Can you see it? Right? People think photographs are something that's visually appreciated. No one disagrees with that, but neither of these things can you see. Right? So if that's true, you haven't yet done enough to create a photograph. That's the crucial thing. That the moment of light exposure is necessary, but not sufficient for something you can visually appreciate, right? And that means that further imaging processes cannot, in principle, be ruled out, right? Because they're going to be required to give you something that can be visually appreciated. Okay, so that's Dawn's fundamental move in this debate. Now, other philosophers have taken up that move and tried to use it to motivate some new thoughts about photography. So first up is Paloma. So remember that this is the target view, Curry's view, as kind of extrapolated from by me. A photograph represents by strictly photographic means if and only if it represents its source by origin and only so represents. Right? Now, here's a question. Should standard darkroom operations be understood as falling under that definition, right? When you pose the question, you realize the problem, which is to say that proponents of the old theory simply have no answer to that question, because it doesn't arise if you think the photograph exists at the moment of click, right? They're all downstream after the thing has happened, right? So for them, naturally, they fall external to what's required for a photograph, but they're wrong that they've given you enough for a photograph. Right? Okay, so that would mean if you're an old theorist, sorry, I mean, that sounds like ages, this terminology. I don't mean if you're like physically old. I mean, if you're a Harvard, you know, school one, let's say. If you're a school one theorist, then you think, or you think you've got principal basis for excluding all those things that photographers, just to take the analog case, have traditionally done in the darkroom. Dodging and burning, selective over and under exposure, combination printing, all the rest of it. Standard tools of photographic imaging,
right? That's all outside the domain of photography proper because the photograph already exists. That's just mucking around, right? But if you think that there's not yet been enough said to give you a visible image, something that can be aesthetically appreciated, then you can't in principle rule those things out. They are necessary, or some version of them is necessary to give you an image. Right, so that's Paloma's example. I don't know how to pronounce her name. Vanda, how do you say that?
Wow.
Yeah, okay, so Iogato, an image of a cat woman. And the claim would be, it's fictionally competent by strictly photographic means. Right, there is no cat woman, right, so it is a fiction, but it uses nothing other than strictly photographic means to represent a cat woman by origin. Right, now, this is actually part of a long tradition of depicting things that didn't exist in front of the camera as depicted photographically, right? So there's a long tradition of Victorian combination printing. These two examples are from Henry Peach Robinson, and they consist of 5 images and 9 images, respectively. This is terrible, terrible photograph. It's by Oscar Rylander. That's like condensed Victoriana, isn't it? The two ways of life. You know, sun, if you go bad, you're on the right, but if you stick to the virtuous path, you're on the left. Am I going the right way now? Maybe not. Yeah, okay. But it's made of 32 images, right? So the point is, all these things have been a traditional part of the practice of photography. So what principle basis is there for ruling them out, particularly if you're only ruling them out on the grounds of a count that doesn't secure a visible image? Okay? Let me give you a few less canonical examples. I digress into a few favorite hobby horses of mine at this point. So this is a less known example by Frank Hurley called An Episode After the Battle of Zonnebeek. Frank Hurley was a war photographer, Australian war photographer. This image is made by 12 separate composite, set 12 separate images which have been combined. If you Google this, you'll find a YouTube video. You can always find a YouTube video, which shows you the process of making the picture by laying each one of these images onto a light-sensitive base. Okay, why am I showing you this? Because of its title, actually. An Episode After the Battle of Zonnebeek, right? This image by Jeff Wall is titled Dead Troops Talk, A Vision After an Ambush of the Red Army Patrol Near Mokhta, Afghanistan, Winter 1986. I think that Jeff Wall is referencing this image in the history of photography, although what he's always taken to be doing is pastiching Jericho's Raft of the Medusa compositionally, which is on the top right. I actually think he's saying something about his relation to this work. I mean, amongst other things he's doing in the history of photography. So let's just think about the Jeff Wall for a moment. Okay. The Jeff Wall, as everyone knows, is a digital composite. You can see this. I mean, if you didn't get it from the fact that there are soldiers with their heads blown off talking to each other, you can see it by the fact that the figure on the left, lying down, looking at a bit of brain matter, and there, I can't step over this guy, he's the same figure as the guy with his brain blown open in the right-hand image. So multiple figures in this image appear twice, right? Remember all the brouhaha that greeted digital photography when it first, you know, in the early 1990s? It's an ontological difference, you know. It's like the end of photography as we know it, right? No. It's just doing something with electronic means that was always there as a capacity in the history of the medium. Maybe it's easier, maybe it's harder to detect, but in principle, it's not different. Okay, so all of that is just to say there's this rich history of using these kind of operations. How can they be excluded? Okay, here's one answer the old theorists, type 1 theorists, are going to come back with. Okay, there's a simple reason for excluding these images, and here it is. They're not naturally, counterfactually dependent on a single spatio-temporally continuous scene. That's a mouthful, so let me unpack it. It's just to say that they're not records of what was in front of the camera at the moment of exposure, and had what was in front of the camera at the moment of exposure been different, they would not necessarily have differed in accordance with how that differed, right? So they're not naturally counterfactually dependent on the scene. Okay, that looks, on the face of it, like a compelling objection, right? Don't we think of photographs as just that? You know, truth-telling recordings of what was in front of the camera. Here's Atencio Linares' response. I'm going to just call her Paloma, right? Because she's Paloma to me. It just seems mouthful to be calling someone in the audience by their surname. Okay, so here's Paloma's response. It begs the question. Why does it beg the question? Well, it just tells you, all that response tells you, is there's a strong background presumption that photographs are mechanistic recordings of what was in front of the camera. But that's precisely what's under debate, right? So you can't appeal to the truth of what's being contested in order to refute it. That's just to beg the question. So as Paloma puts it, it's to reason, X is a picture of Fichte, Fichte can't be photographs, or photographs cannot depict Fichte, so X cannot be a photograph. It's precisely to assume what's being under attack, right? So that's not going to work. Now, in response to that objection, having shown that it's circular or question begging, Paloma does the following. She shows all the respects in which even images like the one she's interested in partake of what's true of photography, right? What's typically thought to be true of photography. So they are traces of objects. They're constrained by real objects. And this fact needs to be appreciated in order to appreciate them. So when you look at the photograph, it matters, even in the Jeff Wall case, that there were models, right? That it's not invented ex nihilo. It's part of appreciating Jeff Wall's achievement to recognize that the image depends on those things. Okay, but look where we are now. Just pause to consider where we are. So what we've got is, as it were, an appeal for exceptions, right? So what Paloma's essentially done is said, look, the theory that all photographs are believed independently dependent upon a scene is implausibly strong. Okay, maybe most photographs are, but there are exceptions. And there's no principle basis for ruling the exceptions out. So what's wrong is the view that photographs are always belief independent, but it's still true that they're typically belief independent. So here's Paloma's little technical suggestion. On the basis of these kind of considerations, she proposes the following amended definition of strictly photographic means. Any action or technique performed or taking place during the production of an image, including the stages of transduction, that's just from latent to patent, and storing, which is to say fixing that image, that consists solely, and this is the important point, solely in the exploitation, manipulation, or control of the incidence of light onto and its interaction with a photosensitive material. So you're probably thinking at the moment, philosophers are just so anal. It's true. It is true. Yeah, we are. Okay. So, now, proponents of the old theory, which is to say type 1 theorists, are going to say, that's way too generous, right? I'm going to tell you it's way too restrictive, right? So, why is that? Okay. What I think Paloma's got right here is something about the significance of light to photography, right? If anything is essential to photography, it's the creation of an image through the manipulation and screening and so on of light. But that's not all photography is, right? Let's just take the analog case. In effect, what I think Paloma's done here, she's identified a subset of photographic processes with the whole, which is to say she's entirely neglected the chemical aspect of photography. Right? Why do I say that? Well, think about some trouble that this definition is going to run into. Remember, the key issue here is the control of the incidence of light onto a photosensitive material. Right, now consider the following cases. Photographer in the dark room wants to selectively occlude some area of a plate or negative from exposing onto the print, right? So they do this. They hold their hands under the enlarger, they move them around, that's dodging, right, to create a soft outline, and they selectively prevent some area of the print surface from being exposed. That's strictly photographic, it's just to occlude light. Now imagine they did this to achieve the same thing. They paint onto the negative with an opaque screen, right? Is that strictly photographic? Well, it is in one sense because it's occluding light, but in another it looks like painterly retouching, and that's going to be strictly forbidden if you are a proponent of this definition. Okay, but that's not a conclusive case, so now consider the second case. Imagine that you want to overexpose some element of the print surface. So you burn in, right? You make a little howl with your hands, or use some baffle, and you selectively allow light to pass through your hands in order to overexpose that element of the print surface. Strictly photographic in this definition. But imagine that a more accurate and expedient way of achieving the same end was to rub intensively with a Q-tip that area of the print in the developer bath. What does that do? It raises the local surface temperature of the print at that point, and it speeds up the darkening of the print. Now you've got a situation where to do this in two different ways, one counts as strictly photographic and one doesn't. Why not? Simply because all the chemical side of photography is being forgotten, right? So that doesn't seem to me acceptable. It seems a bit prescriptive. Why should the photographer who wants their work to count as photography stricto sensu, why are they obliged to take the more roundabout route just because, you know, mucking around in the developer bath is considered non-strictly photographic? Okay? I don't think philosophy should be in the business of legislating to artists or critics about what counts as a photograph in that sense. Okay? Moreover, if you go back to Scruton, which is where we started, this is what Scruton says about examples like this. When the photographer sees the photographic plate, he may still wish to assert his control. He can proceed to paint things in and out or touch them up after alter or pastiche as he pleases, but of course he has now become a painter. In the case of the mucking around in the developer bath or the painting onto the neg or the plate, it looks like Paloma would have to agree. Right? So what does agreeing mean? It means you've endorsed the ground level driving opposition that motivates the old theory, which is the opposition between painting and photography, right? You've ruled out that kind of handwork. Okay. But this isn't the only way. I'm just laying out all sorts of hostages to fortune. It's like painting a big target on myself now, right? So, but this isn't the only way you could go here, right? So call Paloma's response the restrictive route. But there's a permissive route, right? And here's the permissive route. The permissive route is not making an appeal for exceptional cases, right? The cases that nonetheless prove the rule. It's trying to say that actually the standard view is fundamentally misfounded. Right? So here's Dom Lopez. An item is a photograph if and only if it is an image that is a product of a photographic process, where a photographic process includes, one, a photographic event, that's from Dawn, right? A moment of recording of a light image, and two, processes for the production of images. Okay, what's significant about that? Note the independence of the two clauses, right? Clause one gives you, it secures for you, the difference between photographic images and non-photographic images. All photographic images are causally downstream of a photographic event, right? That means that clause two no longer needs to discharge that burden. You've already got it in clause one, right? So clause two can involve anything you like, right? It can involve painting, it doesn't matter, right? Because the distinction is already secured in the first clause. Okay, imagine the following objection. Dom, that's just way too generous, right? So what you need to do is build back in BIFT, right? biffed is my annotation for something that Dom goes on and on about, which is belief-independent feature tracking, right? What you need to do is build back in belief-independent feature tracking. So imagine the following reformulation of Dom Lopez's position. An item is a photograph if and only if it is an image that is a product of a photographic process where that process includes a photographic event as well as processes of the production of images that, three, ensure belief-independent feature tracking. Right? To this, Dom responds, that's just to mistake a subset of photographs for the whole. It will work in domains which are knowledge-orientated, right? So perhaps medical imaging, perhaps archaeological photography, forensics, certainly legal photography, right? But those are domains that are defined socially, right? They have socially imposed norms. The norms are coming from outside photography. It depends on how photography is being used in human practices. So it's not something intrinsic to photography per se. So it won't do as an account of photography in general. Okay. I'm going to end with a couple of challenges to Dom's position. Okay. I'm going to call these two individuation challenges. I'm going to take them in reverse order because I think the second one is easier, and I also think it applies to anyone who's ploughing the photographic event furrow. Okay. So you've got a problem, I think, of individuating particular photographs as photographs of X, and you've got a general problem of individuating photographs in terms of photographic events. Take them in reverse order. Okay, here's a plausible suggestion. How do you tell whether the photograph on the left is the same as the photograph on the right? Do they implicate the same photographic event, right? So you count photographs by counting photographic events, right? This means that were I to put the photograph on a mug, were I to project it onto the face of Senate House, were I to print it on T-shirts, if all those instances implicate the same photographic event, they are instances of the same photograph. Right? So you count photographs by counting photographic events. But here's the worry. What happens when you've got more than one photographic event in the causal story? Right? So all those composite images involve more than one photographic event. How are you going to individuate those? But it's not just for the exceptional cases. You might think that at least any analog photograph involves two photographic events because it includes one or more in camera and one or more in the darkroom. Right? Now, depending on how you individuate the photograph, depending on which photographic event you appeal to, you're going to individuate the photograph differently. And the question is there a principal basis for deciding? Okay, but that's a challenge to anyone who's endorsing a photographic event-based story. Here's the challenge that I'm more interested in, actually, because this is just a challenge for Dom. Okay. It's the challenge of how you individuate a particular photograph. And I'm going to split this into two questions. Is there a principal basis for deciding for either saying when a photograph is finished, or for saying that a given photograph counts as a photograph of X? Right, so let me motivate this thought. Okay. You all know that, right? Very famous painting by Gerhard Richter, Oil on Canvas. For Dom, it's a photograph. Why? Because it implicates a photographic event in its causal history, right? Because it originated back down the causal story from Richter taking a photograph of his daughter Betty, doesn't matter that it's rendered by hand because it's already got enough to distinguish it from merely hand-rendered images in originating in a photographic event. Somewhat counterintuitive, but there you go, that's the theory. Right? Similarly, so it just generalizes across all the photo paintings, right? They're photographs for Dom. Now, you might think, straining at my intuitions at this point, right? But Dom has got some strong backing for this view, right? He's got Richter himself. So here's Richter, who claims he's not making paintings of photographs, and he's not making paintings from photographs, he's making photographs by painting. Here's what he says. I'm not trying to imitate a photograph, I'm trying to make one. And if I disregard the assumptions that a photograph is a piece of paper exposed to light, then I am practicing photography by other means. I'm not producing paintings that remind you of a photograph, but producing photographs. And seen in this way, those of my paintings that have no photographic source, the abstracts, etc., are also photographs. I'm not sure Don will agree with that last claim. Okay. So now look. Okay, so what? Richter says it, right? We don't have to defer to the artist. Is Richter right to say it? Now, here's the thought that I have about this. The appearance of images like this, their photographic look, right? You could mistake that for a photograph here, right? Or in reproduction, is distracting us from potentially just how revisionist and counterintuitive a claim this is. Why do I say that? Well, imagine the following scenario. This is a painting by Richter. It's one of the last in the Baader-Meinhof series of the funeral cortege, right? Imagine that Richter didn't stop there. Right? How does he make his photographs? He takes a photograph. He either squares it up, or I think more likely he uses an opaque projector, which is to say he puts it in the bed of the projector, it projects it onto the canvas, he traces it out, and then he paints it in. When he's nearing completion, he starts dragging the surface of the painting with a solvent, right? The painting's not dry, and you get this characteristic blur that you get in Richter paintings. Now imagine he keeps going, right? He just drags more and more solvent, and eventually he's so dissatisfied with the result, he starts ladling on more paint, and he's dragging it with his trademark silkscreen squeegees, right? Or he ends up with that, right? Now, on Don's account, it looks like this is still a photograph of the funeral cortege, right? Because it implicates a photographic event, the event of that was Richter's original photographic source. So there's nothing fanciful about the example I've just given you. In fact, Richter does this all the time. Now, the question is, what are we going to say about the result? Are we going to say it's a painting? Right? The abstract thing I just showed you, or are we going to say it's a photograph? On Don's account, it looks like we have to say it's a photograph, because it originates in a photographic event, a news picture of the funeral cortege. Okay, so what's it a photograph of? Well, it's a photograph of the funeral, right? Now, this is beginning to look like it's straining credibility, you might think. Now, in a book, this is a bit unfair because it's not yet published, but I've read it. Don talks about... Well, I had to read it because I have to write a response to it, so it's your own fault. Don talks about images, painted images, being shaped, guided by, or under the control of. Those are all direct quotations of a photographic event. These are vague formulations, right? What they don't tell you is what's sufficient control, or sufficient guidance, or sufficient shaping. They don't tell you when the thing is sufficiently controlled by the photographic event to count as a photograph of that event. So, but one thing is clear, right? Don can't appeal to anything like real resemblance, or real similarities, or belief-independent feature tracking to constrain the possibilities, because he's abjured all that in his definition of a photograph. So is there a principled basis for saying whether the Richter abstract I showed you counts as a photograph of the funeral cortege or not? Here's a real example from Richter. Two lions with tourists. One lion with tourist. One lion with tourist. Tourist. Right? Now, Dom, is it a photograph of a tourist? Or is it a monochrome abstract painting? Maybe it's both. In fact, it looks like Dom wants to say it's both. Right? Arguably, he equivocates on this point. So Richter uses various processes, which are painting processes, right? Puts on paint by hand, hand-eye coordination, all those kind of things, moves his body in certain ways. That makes it a painting, but the fact that it involves a photographic event makes it a photograph. And Dom's happy to say some images can be both. But then it looks like he's going to have to say, it's a photograph of a tourist and a monochrome grey painting. Okay. Right. That's enough Dom bashing. Right, where have we got to? So what I've tried to suggest is that we've got an invidious choice. Right? We've got, on the one hand, a restrictive account of photographic means, which identifies a subset of such means with the whole, which is, say, the light side of photography, the optical side at the expense of the chemical side. On the other, we have a much more permissive account, which doesn't look like it's got a principled and acceptable answer to the question of when a photograph counts as a photograph for X. Right? So there's some challenges for the new theory. You can see why I put myself up first, so then I'm just going to duck. Right? Okay, let me leave you with one last thought. I'm in favour of this theory. I just think there are things that need to be worked out here. Let me show you some, in conclusion, some capacities this theory has that I've not even talked about at all. Okay, remember this? Wilson's multi-stage theory? Look at the line in orange. Dom and Dorn have slightly different versions of the theory, but they share this. The information stored undergoes a process or processes for the creation of a visual image, right? That's all downstream of the photographic event, right? That's all I've talked about. But look, the photographer on this account can also intervene upstream of the photographic event, right? They can play with the pro-photographic scene, which is to say they can construct it, and that can be part of making a photograph. They can interfere with the rendering of the scene by using filters and mirrors and diffractors and all sorts of things to give you an image that isn't an image that appears the way the pro-photographic scene appears. And that will count too, because it's all part of playing with the light image. So what if the worries that I've suggested the theory still has can be ironed out, what you end up with is a philosophical theory which is capable of making sense of a whole raft of contemporary photographic art that the old guys, type 1 theorists, can't. I think that's enough. Thanks.